Chapter 7. Shimmer's Union Council State, 13-5-75. He could feel it coming on, creeping across the back of his head in a zone of quivering subepidermal tightness, a fugue state. The scene before him trembled slightly, the crowds below his private box blurred in a frieze of packed heads against dark finery, the rounded stage with actors in costume, dark red, gleaming. A gesture. It slowed. It froze. Fear. No, not even that exactly. A certain sadness now that the die was cast. The waiting was the hell of it. He had waited 60 years to resume his old contacts, the wirehead radical old of the Republic. Now the wirehead leaders, like him, had worked their way to power in the worlds outside. 60 years was nothing to a mind on the wires. Time meant nothing. Fugue states. They still remembered him quite well, their friend, Philip Curie Constantine. It was he who had sprung them loose, purging the middle-aged aristocrats to finance the wirehead defections. Memories went back. They were data, that was all. Just as fresh on reels somewhere as the enemy Margaret Giuliano was on her bed of cataclysm ice. Even amid fugue, the surge of satisfaction was quick and sharp enough to penetrate into the consciousness of his back brains. That unique sense of warmth that came only from the downfall of a rival. Now trailing sluggishly behind his racing thoughts, the slow motion blooming of a light tingle of fear. Nora Everett. The wife of Abelard Mavrides. She had hurt him 17 years ago, with the coup in the Republic, though he was able to entangle her in charges of treason. The tin-pot Republic was of no concern to him now, its willfully ignorant child citizens flying kites and eating apples under the crazed charlatan gaze of Dr. Pongpian School. No problem there. The future would ignore them. They were living fossils, harmless in themselves. But the cataclysts. The fear was resolving itself now, beginning to flower, its first dim shades of backbrain unease taking on emotional substance now, uncoiling through his consciousness like a drop of ink streaming into a glass of water. He would see to his emotions later when the fugue was over. Now he was struggling to shut his eyes. Focus was lost. Dim tear blur over frozen performers. His eyelids were dropping with nightmare sluggishness, nerve impulses confused by the racing fugue consciousness. The cataclysts, though. They took it all as an enormous joke, enjoyed hiding in the Republic disguised as plebes and farmers. The huge panorama interior of the cylindrical world as weird to them as a trace dose of their favorite drug, PDKL-95. The cataclysm mindset fed on correspondences and poetic justice, a trip to the human past in the Neotenic Republic, the inverse of an ICE assassination, with its one-way ticket to the future. The fugue was about to break. He felt a strange cracking sensation of psychic upheaval. Mental crust gave way before the upsurge. In the last microseconds of fugue, an eidetic flash seized him. Surveyor photos from the surface of Titan, red volcanic shelves of heavy hydrocarbons split by ammonia lava, bursting from the depths. From Titan, far below their orbit, prime wall decor in Skimmer's Union. Gone. Constantine leaned forward in his box seat, clearing his throat. Delayed fear swept over him. He pushed it brusquely away, had a light sniff of acetaminophen to avert migraine. He glanced at his wristwatch through damp lashes. 4 seconds of fugue. He wiped his eyes, became aware of his wife sitting beside him, her finely chiseled shaper face a study in surprise. Was she aware that he had been sitting rapt for 4 seconds, with his eyes showing only a rim of white? No. She thought he was touched by the play, was startled to see his excess of emotion in her iron-hard husband. Constantine favored her with a smile. Her color heightened. She leaned forward in her seat, her jeweled hands in her lap, studying the play alertly. Later, she would try to discuss it with him. Natalie Constantine was young and bright, the scion of a military gene line. She had grown used to his demands. Not like his first wife, the treasonous bitch. He had left the old aristocrat in the Republic, having nurtured her vicious streak patiently until his own coup allowed him to turn it against her peers. Now, rumor said she was Pong Pian School's lover, won over by fraudulent shaper charm and degraded senile intimacy. No matter, no matter. Long years had taken the sting from it. Tonight's stroke, if it came, was more important than any circumlunar moondock. His 9-year-old daughter, Vera, leaned in her seat to whisper to Natalie. Constantine gazed at the child he had built. Half her genetics were Vera Kellen's, drawn from skin flakes he had taken before the woman's suicide. For years he had treasured the stolen genes, and when the time was ripe, he had brought them to flower in this child. She was his favorite, the first of his progeny. When he thought how his own failure might doom her, he felt the fear again, sharper than before, because it was not for himself. An extravagant gesture from the stage caught his attention, a brief flurry of stilted action as the deranged super-bright villain clutched his head and fell. Constantine surreptitiously scratched his ankle with the sole of his foot glove. Over the years, his skin virus had improved, limited to dry outbreaks of shingles at his extremities. The play was one of Zeuner's, and it bored him. Skimmer's Union had caught the habit from Goldreich Tremaine, bolstered by dramatists fleeing the crippled ex-capital. But the modern theater was lifeless. Fernand Wetterling, for instance, author of The White Periapsis and The Technical Advisor, languished in sullen silence with his disgraced Mavridi's wife. Other artists with detentiste leanings now paid for their indiscretion with fines or house arrest. Some had defected. Others had gone under time to join the cataclyst action brigades in the graveyard day shifts. But the cataclysts were losing cohesion, becoming mere terrorists. Their super-bright elite was under severe attack. The pogrom on the super-brights was increasingly thorough as hysteria mounted. Their promoters and educators were now political non-persons, many having fallen to the twisted vengeance of the super-brights themselves. The super-brights were too brilliant for community. They demanded the world-shattering anarchy of supermen. That could not be tolerated, and Constantine had served that intolerance. Life had never looked better for him. High office, his own Constantine gene line, a free hand for anti-mech adventurism, and his own barbed nets poised for disloyalty. And tonight he had risked it all. Would his news ever come? How would he hear it? From his bodyguards through the earpiece? Through the stolen mech implants in his own brain that opened internal channels to the thin data whispers of the wireheads? Or... something was happening. The banner-waving choreography on the curved stage disintegrated in sudden confusion, the colored corporate logos and gene-line insignia slowing and tangling. The dancers fell back in chaos in response to shouted orders. Someone was floating to the edge of the podium. It was the wretched Charles Wetterling, his aged face bloated with triumph and a lackey's self-importance. This was it. Wetterling was shouting. The play's leading man gave him a throat mic. Wetterling's voice roared suddenly in thudding feedback.
Of the war, mech markets are in panic. The asteroid Nyssa has declared for the Ring Council. I repeat, the Nyssa cartel has abandoned the Mechanist Union. They have asked for admittance as a Ring Council treaty state. The Council is meeting.
His words were drowned in the roar from the audience, the clatter of buckles as they unstrapped from their seats and rose in confusion. Wetterling struggled with the mic. Patches of his words broke the din.
Capitulation! Through banks in Skimmer's Union! Industrial! New victory!
It started among the actors. The leading man was pointing above the heads of the audience at Constantine's box, shouting fiercely at the rest of the cast. One of the women began applauding. Then it spread. The whole cast was applauding, their faces alight. Wetterling heard them behind him, turned to look. He grasped things at once, and a stiff smile spread over his face. He pointed dramatically.
"Constantine," he shouted. "Ladies and gentlemen, the Chancellor General."
Constantine rose to his feet, gripping the iron banister behind the transparent shield. When they saw him, the crowd exploded, a free-fall maelstrom of shouts and applause. They knew it was his triumph. The joy of it overwhelmed them, the brief, bright release from the dark tension of the war. If he'd failed, they would have hounded him to death with the same passion. But that dark knowledge had been blasted by victory, because he'd won. Now the risk he'd run only sharpened his delight. He turned to his wife. Her eyes brimmed over with tears of pride. Slowly, not leaving the banister, he extended his hand to her. When their fingers touched, he read her face. He saw the truth there. From this night on, his dominion over her was total. She took her place beside him. Vera tugged his sleeve, her eyes wide. He lifted her up, cradling her in his left arm. His lips touched her ear.
"Remember this," he whispered fiercely.
The anarchic shouts died down as another rhythm spread. It was the rhythm of applause, the long, cadenced ritual applause that followed every session of the Ring Council itself. Ageless, solemn, overwhelming applause. Applause that brooked no dissent. The music of power. Constantine raised his wife's hand above their heads and closed his eyes. It was the happiest moment of his life. Dembowska Cartel, 15-5-75. Lindsay was playing keyboards for the sake of his new arm. It was much more advanced than his old one, and the fine discrimination of its nerve signals confused him. As he ran through the composition, one of Kitsune's, he felt each key click down with a brief, muddled sensation of sharp heat. He rested, rubbing his hands together. A pins and needles tingling ran up the wires. The new hand was densely honeycombed with fingertip sensors. They were much more responsive than his old arm's feedback pads. The change had jarred him. He looked about his desolate apartment. In 22 years, it had never been anything more to him than a place to camp. The apartment's fashions, its ribbed wallpaper and skeletal chairs, were 2 decades out of date. Only the security systems, Wells's latest, had any touch of the mode. Lindsay himself had gone stale. At 90, grooves marked his eyes and mouth from decades of habitual expression. His hair and beard were sprinkled with gray. He was improving at the keyboards. He had attacked the problem of music with his usual inhuman steadiness. For years he had worked hard enough to kill himself, but modern biomonitoring technique saw each breakdown coming and averted it months ahead of time. The bed took care of that, feeding him subterranean flashes of intense and blurry dream that left him each morning blank and empty with perfect mental health. 18 years had passed since his wife's remarriage. The pain of it had never fully hit him. He'd known her present husband briefly in the council. Graham Everett, a colorless detentiste with powerful clan connections. Nora used Everett's influence to parry the attacks of militants. It was sad. Lindsay didn't remember the man well enough to hate him. Warnings cut short his playing. Someone had arrived at his entry hall. The scanners there assured him that the visitor, a woman, bore only harmless mechanist implants, plaque-scraping arterial microbots, old-fashioned Teflon kneecaps, plastic knuckles, a porous drug duct in the crook of the left elbow. Much of her hair was artificial, implanted strands of shining optical fibers. He had his household servo escort the woman in. She had the strange complexion common to many older mechanist women, smooth, unblemished skin like a perfectly form-fitted paper mask. Her red hair was shot through with copper highlights from the fiber optics. She wore a sleeveless gray suit, furred vest, and elbow-length white thermal gloves.
"Auditor Milosh?"
She had a concatenate accent. He ushered her to the couch. She sat gracefully, her movements honed to precision by age.
"Yes, madam, what may I do for you?" "Forgive me for intruding, auditor, My name is Tyler. I'm a clerk with Limonov Cryonics, but my business here is personal. I've come to ask for your help. I've heard of your friendship with Neville Pongpian School.
You're Alexandrina Tyler, Lindsay realized aloud. From Mare Serenitatis, the Republic. She looked surprised and lifted her thin, arched brows.
You already know my case, Auditor?
You. Lindsay sat down in the stirruped chair. Would like a drink, perhaps? She was his first wife. From some deeply buried level of reflex, he felt the stirrings of a long-dead persona, a brittle layer of false kinesics he had put between them in their marriage. Alexandrina Tyler, his wife, his mother's cousin.
No, thank you, she said.
She adjusted the fabric over her knees. She'd always had trouble with her knees. She'd had the Teflon put in the Republic. Her familiar gesture brought it all back to him. The marriage politics of the Republic's aristocrats. She had been 50 years his senior, their marriage a stifling net of strained politeness and grim rebellion. Lindsay was 90 now, older than she had been at their marriage. With a flood of new perspective, he could taste the long-forgotten pain that he had caused her.
I was born in the Republic, she said. I lost my citizenship in the Shaper purges. Almost 50 years ago. I loved the Republic, Auditor. I've never forgotten it. I came from one of the privileged families, but I thought, perhaps now, since the new regime there has settled, surely that's all a dead issue?
You were Abelard Lindsay's wife. Her eyes widened.
So you do know my case. You know I've applied to emigrate. I have no response from the Pongpian School government. I've come to ask for your help, Auditor. I'm not a member of your Carbon clique, but I know their power. You have influence that works around the laws.
Life must have been difficult for you, madam. Thrown out without resources into the schismatrics. She blinked, china white lids falling over her eyes like paper shutters.
Things were not so bad once I'd reached the cartels. But I can't pretend I've known happiness. I haven't forgotten home, the trees, the gardens.
Lindsay nodded his hands, ignoring the tingle of confused sensation from his right. I can't encourage false hopes, madam. Neotenic law is very strict. The Republic has no interest in those our age, those who are estranged in any way from the raw state of humanity. It's true that I've handled some matters for the Neotenic government. Those involve the resettlement of Neotenic citizens who reach the age of 60. Dying out into the world, they call it. The flow of emigration is strictly one way. I'm very sorry. She was silent a moment.
You know the Republic well, Auditor.
Her voice told him that she had accepted defeat. Now she was hunting for memories. Well enough to know that the wife of Abelard Lindsay has been defamed. Your late husband is regarded there as a preservationist martyr. They portray you as a mechanist collaborator, driving Lindsay into exile and death.
How terrible!
Her eyes filled with tears. She stood up in agitation.
I'm very sorry. May I use your biomonitor?
Tears don't alarm me, madam, Lindsay said gently. I am not a Zen serotonist.
My husband, she said. He was such a bright boy. We thought we'd done well when we scholarshiped him to the Shapers. I never understood what they did to him, but it was horrible. I tried to make our marriage work, but he was so clever, so smooth and plausible, that he could twist anything I said or did to serve some other purpose. He terrified the others. They swore he would rip our world apart. We should never have sent him to the Shapers.
I'm sure it seemed a wise decision at the time, Lindsay said. The Republic was already in the mechanist orbit, and they wanted to redress the balance.
Then they shouldn't have done it to my cousin's son. There were plenty of plebes to send out, people like Constantine.
She put one wrinkled knuckle to her lips.
I'm sorry. That's aristocratic prejudice. Forgive me, Auditor, I'm distraught.
I understand, Lindsay said. To those our age, old memories can come with unexpected force. I'm very sorry, madam. You have been treated unjustly.
Thank you, sir.
She accepted a tissue from the household servo.
Your sympathy touches me deeply.
She dabbed at her eyes with precise, bird-like movements.
I almost feel that I know you.
A trick of memory, Lindsay said. I was married once to a woman much like you. A slow look passed between them. A great deal was said below the level of words. The truth surfaced briefly, was acknowledged, and then vanished beneath the necessity for subterfuge.
This wife, she said, her face was flushed. She did not accompany you on your journey here.
Marriage in Dembowska is a different situation, Lindsay said.
I was married here. A 5-year contract marriage. Polygamous. It expired last year.
You are currently unattached? She nodded. Lindsay gestured about the room with a whir of his right arm. Myself as well. You can see the state of my domestic affairs. My career has made my life rather arid. She smiled tentatively. Would you be interested in the management of my household? An assistant auditorship would pay rather better than your current position, I think.
I'm sure it would.
Shall we say a 6-month probationary period against a 5-year joint management contract? Standard terms. Monogamous. I can have my office print out a contract by tomorrow morning.
This is quite sudden.
Nonsense, Alexandrina. At our age, if we put things off, we never accomplish anything. What's 5 years to us? We've reached the age of discretion.
May I have that drink? She said. It's bad for my maintenance program, but I think I need it.
She looked at him nervously, a ghost of strained intimacy waking behind her eyes. He looked at her smooth paper skin, the brittle precision of her hair. He realized that his gesture of atonement would add another rote to his life, a new form of routine. He restrained a sigh. I look to you to set our sexuality clause. Shimmer's Union Council State, 23-6-83. Constantine looked into the tank. Behind the glass window, below the surface of the water, was the waterlogged head of Paolo Mavridis. The dark, curled hair, a major trait of the Mavridis gene line, floated soggily around the young man's neck and shoulders. The eyes were open, greenish and bloodshot. Injections had paralyzed his optic nerve. A spinal clamp left him able to feel, but not to move. Blind and deaf, numbed by the blood-warmed water, Paolo Mavridis had been in sensory isolation for 2 weeks. A tracheal plug fed him oxygen. Intravenous taps kept him from starving. Constantine touched a black rocker switch on the welded tank, and the jury-rigged speakers came alive. The young assassin was talking to himself, some mumbled litany in different voices. Constantine spoke into the microphone. Paolo.
I'm busy, Paolo said. Come back later.
Constantine chuckled. Very well. He tapped against the microphone to make the sound of a switch closing.
No, wait,
Paolo said at once. Constantine smiled at the trace of panic.
Never mind. The performance is ruined anyway. Vetterling's Shepherd Moons.
Hasn't had a performance in years, Constantine said. You must have been a mere child then.
I memorized it when I was 9.
I'm impressed by your resourcefulness. Still, the cataclysts believe in that, don't they? Testing the inner world of the will. You've been in there quite a while. Quite a while.
There was silence. Constantine waited.
How long?
Mavridis burst out.
Almost 48 hours.
Mavridis laughed shortly. Constantine joined in.
Of course we know that isn't so. No, it's been almost a year. You'd be surprised how thin you look.
You should try it sometime. Might help your skin problems.
Those are the least of my difficulties, young man. I made a tactical error when I chose the best security possible. It made me a challenge. You'd be surprised how many fools have had this tank before you. You made a mistake, young Paolo.
Tell me something, Paolo said. Why do you sound like God?
That's a technical artifact. My voice is a direct feed to your inner ear. That's why you can't hear your own voice. I'm reading it off the nerves to your larynx.
I see, Paolo said. Wirehead work.
Nothing irreversible. Tell me about yourself, Paolo. What was your brigade?
I'm no cataclyst.
I have your weapon here. Constantine pulled a small timer vial from his tailored linen jacket and rolled it between his fingers. Standard cataclyst issue. What is it? PDKL-95? Paolo said nothing. Perhaps you know the drug as Shatter, Constantine said. Paolo laughed.
I know better than to try to reform your mind. If I could have entered the same room with you, I would have said it for 5 seconds, and we would have both died.
An aerosol toxin, is it? How rash.
There are more important things than living, plebe.
What a quaint insult. I see you've researched my past. Haven't heard the like in years. Next you'll be saying I'm unplanned.
No need. Your wife tells us that much.
I beg your pardon?
Natalie Constantine, your wife, ever hear of her? She doesn't take neglect easily. She's become the prime whore of Skimmer's Union.
How distressing.
How do you think I planned to enter your house? Your wife's a slut. She begs me for it.
Constantine laughed. You'd like me to strike you, wouldn't you? The pain would give you something to hold on to. No, you should have stayed in Cold Reich Tremaine, young man, in those empty halls and broken-down offices. I'm afraid you've begun to bore me.
Let me tell you what I regret before you go. I regret that I set my sights so low. I've had time to think recently.
Hollow laughter.
I fell for your image, your propaganda line. The Nisa asteroid, for instance. It seemed so grand at first. The Ring Council didn't know that Nisa Cartel was a dumping ground for burnt-out wireheads from the moon docks. You were still sucking up to aristocrats from the Republic. With all your rank, you're still a cheap informer, Constantine. And a fucking lackey.
Constantine felt a quiver of familiar tension across the back of his head. He touched the plug there and reached in his pocket for the inhaler. No use going into fugue when the boy was starting to babble, at the point of breaking. Go on, he said.
The great things you claim you've done are all facades and frauds. You've never built anything of your own. You're small, Constantine, very small. I know a man who could hide 10 of you under his thumbnail.
Who? Constantine said. Your friend, Vetterling?
Poor Fernand? Your victim? Yes, of course he's 1,000 times your size. But that's hardly fair, is it? You never had an atom of artistic talent. No, I mean in your own skill. Politics. Espionage.
Some cataclyst, then. Constantine was bored.
No, Abelard Lindsay.
It hit him then. A lightning stroke of migraine raced across his left frontal lobe. The surface of the tank came toward him in slow motion as he fell, a frozen ice cape of dull metallic glitter, and he struggled to get his hands up, nerve impulses locked in a high-speed fugue that seemed to last a month. When he came to, his cheek pressed against the cold metal, Mavridis was still babbling.
The whole story from Nora. While you were here holding treason trials for artists, Lindsay was scoring the biggest coup in history. An investor defector. He has an investor defector, a starship queen, in the palm of his hand.
Constantine cleared his throat. I heard that news. Mech propaganda. It's a farce.
Mavridis laughed hysterically.
You're burned. You're a fucking footnote. Lindsay led the revolution in your nation while you were still swatting bugs in the germs and muck and plotting to seize his credit. You're microscopic. I shouldn't have bothered to kill you, but I've never had any luck.
Lindsay's dead. He's been dead 60 years.
Sure, plebe. That's what he wanted you to think.
The laughter from the speakers was metallic, drawn straight from the nerve.
I lived in his house, fool. He loved me.
Constantine opened the tank. He twisted the timer on the vial and dropped it into the water, then slammed the tank shut. He turned and walked away. As he reached the doorway, he heard a sudden frenzied splashing as the toxin hit. Tsarina Cluster, People's Corporate Republic, 3-1-84. The long, bright line of welded radiance was the cleanest thing he had ever seen. Lindsay floated in an observation bubble, watching construction robots crawl in vacuum. The mechanist engines had the long, sharp noses of weevils, their white-hot welding tips casting long shadows across the blackened hull of the Tsarina's palace. They were building a full-sized replica of an investor starship, a starship without engines, a hulk that would never move under its own power. And black, with no trace of the gaudy arabesques and inlays of a true investor craft. The other investors had insisted on it, condemned their pervert queen to this dark and mocking prison. After years of research, Lindsay had pieced out the truth about the commander's crime. Queens intromitted their eggs into the womb-like pouches of their males. The males fertilized the eggs and brought them to term within the pouch. The neuter ensigns controlled ovulation through a complex hormonal pseudo-copulation. The criminal queen had killed her ensign in a fit of passion and set up a common male in his place. But without a true ensign, the cycles of her sexuality had become distorted. Lindsay's evidence showed her destroying one of her malformed eggs. To an investor, it was worse than perversion, worse even than murder. It was bad for business. Lindsay had presented his evidence in a way that pierced to the core of investor ethics. Embarrassment was not an emotion native to investors. They had been stunned. But Lindsay was quick with a remedy. Exile. Behind it was the implied threat to spread the evidence, to play out the details of the scandal to every investor ship and every human faction. It was bad enough that a select group of wealthy queens and ensigns had been apprised of the shocking news. That the impressionable males should learn of it was unthinkable. A bargain was struck. The queen never knew what had betrayed her. The approach to her had been even more subtle, stretching Lindsay's talents to the utmost. A timely gift of jewels had helped, distracting her with that overwhelming avidity that was the very breath of life to investors. Business had been poor on her ship, with its debased crew and wretched eunuch ensign. Lindsay came armed with charts from Wells, statistics predicting the wealth to be wrung from a city-state independent of faction. Their exponential curves rose to a clean rake-off to breathtaking riches. He told her that he knew nothing of her disgrace, only that her own species was eager to condemn her. With a large enough hoard, he hinted, she might buy her way back into their good graces. Patiently, fluently, he helped her see that this was her best chance. What could she accomplish alone, without crew, without ensign? Why not accept the industrious aid of the small, polite strangers? The social instincts of the tiny, gregarious mammals drove them to consider her their queen, in truth, and themselves her subjects. Already a board of advisors awaited her whims, each one fluent in investor, and begging leave to heap her with wealth. Greed would only have taken her so far. It was fear that broke her to his will. Fear of the small, soft-skinned alien with dark plastic over his pulpy eyes and his answers for everything. He seemed to know her own people better than she did herself. The announcement had come a week later, and with it a sudden hemorrhage of capital to the newborn place of exile. They called the queen Tsarina, a nickname given by Reuman, and her city was Tsarina Cluster. In 4 months, already a boomtown, accreting out of nothing on the inner edge of the belt. The Tsarina Cluster People's Corporate Republic had leaped into sudden concrete existence out of raw potential, in what Wells called a prigogenic leap, emergence into a higher level of complexity. Now the Board of Advisors was deluged with business, comm lines frantic with would-be defectors maneuvering for asylum and a fresh start. The presence of an investor cast an enormous shadow, a wall of prestige that no mechanist or shaper dared to challenge. Makeshift squatters' digs crowded the Queen's raw palace, nets of tough shaper bubble suburbs, subbles, sleazy pirate craft copulating in a daisy chain of accordioned attack tunnels, rough blown-out honeycombs of mechanist nickel iron towed into place, limpet-like construction huts clinging to the skeletal girders of an urban complex scarcely off the drawing board. This city would be a metropolis, a circumsolar freeport, the ultimate sundog zone. He had brought it into being, but it was not for him. "A sight to stir the blood, friend." Lindsay looked to his right. The man once called Wells had arrived in the observation bubble. In the weeks of preparation, Wells had vanished into a carefully prepared false identity. He was now Wellspring, 200 years old, born on Earth, a man of mystery, a maneuverer par excellence, a visionary, even a prophet. Nothing less would do. A coup this size demanded legendary. It demanded fraud. Lindsay nodded. "Things progress." "This is where the real work starts. I'm not too happy with that Board of Advisors. They seem a bit too stuffy, too mechanist. Some of them have ambition. They'll have to be watched."
"Of course."
"You wouldn't consider the job. The coordinator's post is open for you. You're the man for it."
"I like the shadows, Wellspring. A role your size is too close to the footlights for me."
Wellspring hesitated. "I have trouble enough with the philosophy. The myth may be too much for me. I need you and your shadows."
Lindsay looked away, watching two construction robots follow a seam to meet in a white-hot kiss of their welding brakes.
"My wife is dead," he said.
"Alexandrina? I'm sorry. This is a shock."
Lindsay winced.
"No, not her. Nora. Nora Mavridis. Nora Everett."
"Ah," Wellspring said. "When did you get the news?"
"I told her," Lindsay said, "that I had a place for us. You remember I mentioned to you that there might be a Ring Council breakaway?"
"Yes."
"It was as quiet as I could make it, but not quiet enough. Constantine got word somehow, exposed the breakaway. She was indicted for treason. The trial would have implicated the rest of her clan. So she chose suicide."
"She was courageous."
"It was the only thing to do."
"One supposes so."
"She still loved me, Wellspring. She was going to join me here. She was trying to do it when he killed her."
"I recognize your grief," Wellspring said. "But life is long. You mustn't be blinded to your ultimate aims."
Lindsay was grim. "You know I don't follow that post-cataclyst line."
"Post-humanist," Wellspring insisted. "Are you on the side of life, or aren't you? If you're not, then you'll let the pain overwhelm you. You'll go against Constantine and die as Nora did. Accept her death and stay with us. The future belongs to post-humanism, Lindsay. Not to nation-states, not to factions. It belongs to life, and life moves in clades."
"I've heard your spiel before, Wellspring. If we embrace the loss of our humanity, then it means worse differences, worse struggle, worse war."
"Not if the new clades can reach accord as cognitive systems on the fourth pregogenic level of complexity."
Lindsay, despairing, was silent. Finally, he said, "I wish you the best of luck here, sincerely. Protect the damage if you can. Maybe it'll come to something."
"There's a universe of potential, Lindsay. Think of that. No rules, no limits."
"Not while he lives. Forgive me."
"You'll have to do that for yourself." An investor trade ship, 14286.
This is not the sort of transaction we prefer, the investor said.
Have we met before, Ensign? Said Lindsay.
No, I knew one of your students once, Captain Dr. Simon Afriel, a very accomplished gentleman.
I remember Simon well.
He died on embassy.
The investor stared, his dark eyeballs gleaming with hostility above the white rims of his nictitating membranes.
A pity. I always enjoyed his conversation. Still, he had that urge to meddle, to tamper. You call it curiosity. An urge to value useless data. A being with such a handicap runs a great many unnecessary risks.
Without a doubt, Lindsay agreed. He had not heard of Afriel's death. The knowledge filled him with bitter pleasure. Another fanatic gone. Another gifted life wasted.
Hatred is an easier motive to fathom. Strange that you should fall prey to it, artist. It makes me doubt my judgment of your species.
I regret being a source of confusion. Chancellor General Constantine might explain it better.
I'll speak to him. He and his party have just come aboard. He is not a fit model, though, for a judgment on human nature. Our scanning reveals that he favors severe alterations.
Many did these days, Lindsay thought, even the very young, as if the existence of the Neotenic Republic with its forced humanity freed the other factions from a stifling pretense. You find this odd in a space-going race?
No, not at all. That is why there are so few of them left.
19, Lindsay said.
Yes, the number of vanished races within our trading realm is larger by an order of magnitude. Their artifacts persist, though, such as the one we plan to lease to you presently.
The investor showed him striated, peg-like teeth, a sign of distaste and reluctance.
We'd hoped for truly long-term trade with your species, but we cannot dissuade you from aiming for breakthroughs in questions of metaphysics. We will soon have to put your solar system under quarantine for fear of being caught in your transmutations. In the meantime, we must abandon a few scruples to make our local investments worthwhile.
You alarm me, Lindsay said. He had heard this before, vague warnings from the investors, intended to freeze humanity at its current level of development. It amused him that investors should preach preservationism. Surely the war is a greater threat.
No,
the investor said.
We ourselves presented you with evidence. Our interstellar drive showed you that space-time is not what you thought. You must be aware of this, artist. Consider recent breakthroughs in the mathematical treatment of what you call Hilbert space and the space of the pre-continuum. They can't have escaped your attention.
Mathematics isn't my forte, Lindsay said.
Nor ours. We only know that these discoveries are danger signs of an imminent transition to another mode of being.
Imminent?
Yes, a matter of mere centuries.
Centuries, Lindsay thought. It was easy to forget how old the investors were. Their deep disinterest in change gave them a wide but shallow field of view. They had no interest in their own history, no urge to contrast their own lives with those of their dead, because there was no assumption that their lives or motives varied in even the slightest degree. They had vague legends and garbled technical readouts concerning particularly prized objects of booty, but even these fragments of history were lost in a jackdaw scramble of loot.
Not all the extinct races made the transition, the ensign said. And those who invented the arena probably died violently. We have no data on that, only technical data on their modes of perception, allowing us to make the arena comprehensible to the human nervous system. In this we had the assistance of the Department of Neurology, from the cosmosity of the Nisa corporate treaty state.
Constantine's recruits, Lindsay thought. The Nisa rogue wireheads, mechanist defectors to the Shaper cause, combining mech techniques with the fascist structure of the Shaper academic military complex. The very men, the very beings, rather, for the job.
So said the Chancellor General. His party has assembled now. Shall we join them?
Constantine's group mingled with Lindsay's in one of the cavernous lounges of the investor ship. The lounge was crowded with towering rococo furniture, dizzyingly over-decorated settees and slab-like tables, supported on curved legs crusted with ribbed domes and stylized scrolls. It was all far too large to be of any conventional use to the score of human visitors, who crouched under the furniture warily, careful not to touch anything. Lindsay saw, as he entered the lounge, that the alien furnishings had been sprayed with a thick, protective lacquer to guard them from oxygen. He had never seen any of the young Constantine genetics. Constantine had brought 10 of them, 5 women, 5 men. The Constantine siblings were taller than Constantine and had lighter hair, clearly a percentage cut from some other gene line. They had that peculiar Shaper magnetism, an acrobatic smoothness and fluidity. Yet something in the set of their shoulders, their slim, dexterous hands, kinesically displayed Constantine's genetic history. They wore outlandish finery, round velvet hats, ruby earrings, and gold-laced brocade coats. They dressed for the sake of investors, who appreciated a prosperous look in their customers. One woman had her back to Lindsay, examining the towering legs of the furniture. The others stood calmly, trading meaningless pleasantries with Lindsay's people, a motley group of academics and investor specialists on leave from Tsarina Cluster. His wife, Alexandrina, was among them. She was talking to Constantine himself, with her usual perfect good breeding. Nothing showed that all of them were seconds to a duel, witnesses present to assure fairness. It had been a 2-year struggle, a matter of prolonged and delicate negotiation, to arrange a meeting between himself and Constantine. At last they had settled on the investor starship as a suitable battleground, one where treachery would be counterproductive. The arena itself had remained in investor hands. The Nisa technicians had worked on data freely available to both parties. The costs were split equitably, with Constantine assuming most of the financing, on an option against possible technological spin-offs. Lindsay had received data through a double-blind in Tsarina Cluster and Dombowska to confuse possible assassins. Constantine, to his credit, had sent no one. The mechanics of their duel had been fraught with difficulty. Varying proposals had been debated by an ever-widening circle of those in the know. Physical combat was rejected at once as beneath the dignity of the estranged parties. Those familiar with the social gambling of the Shaper world favored a form of gambling for suicide. An appeal to chance, though, presumed equality between the parties, which neither was willing to grant. A proper duel should assure the triumph of the better man. It was argued that this required a test of alertness, will, and mental flexibility, qualities central to modern life. Objective tests were possible, but it was difficult to ensure that one party would not prepare himself ahead of time or influence the judges. Various forms of direct mind-to-mind struggle existed among the wirehead community, but these often lasted for decades and involved radical alterations of the faculties. They decided to consult the investors. At first, the investors had difficulty grasping the concept. Later, characteristically, they suggested economic warfare, with each party granted a stake and offered the opportunity to increase it. After a stated period, the poorer man was to be executed. This was not satisfactory. Another investor suggestion involved attempts by both parties to read the literature of the untranslatable, but it was suggested that the survivor might repeat something of what he had read and become a hazard to the rest of humanity. At this point, the arena was rediscovered in one of the booty-cramped holds of an investor craft present in circumsolar space. Study quickly showed the arena's advantages. Alien forms of experience challenged even the finest members of society, the emissaries to alien worlds. The extremely high casualty rate among this group proved that the arena would be a test in itself. Within the arena's simulated environment, the duelists would battle in two alien bodies of guaranteed equality, thus ensuring that victory would go to the superior strategist. Constantine stood between one of the towering tables, sipping a self-chilling silver goblet of distilled water. Like his gaudily clad congenetics, he wore soft lace-cuffed trousers and a gold-threaded coat, its high collar studded with insignias of rank. His round, delicate eyes gleamed black with soft anti-glare lenses. His face, like Lindsay's, was creased where years of habitual expression had worked their way into the muscles. Lindsay wore a dun-brown jumpsuit without markings. His face was oiled against the blue-white glare, and he wore dark sunshades. He crossed the room to join Constantine. A hush fell, but Constantine gestured urbanely, and his fellow genetics picked up the tag ends of their conversations.
"Hello, cousin," Constantine said.
Lindsay nodded.
"A fine group of congenetics, Philip. Congratulations on your siblings." "Good sound stock," Constantine agreed. "They handle the gravity well."
He looked pointedly at Lindsay's wife, who had shuffled tactfully toward another group, visibly troubled by pain in her knees.
"I spent a lot of time on gene politics," Lindsay said. "In retrospect, it seems like an aristocratic fetish."
Constantine's lids narrowed over the black adhesive lenses.
"A little more work on the Mavridis production run might have been in order."
Lindsay felt a surge of cold fury.
"Their loyalties betrayed them."
Constantine sighed.
"The irony hasn't escaped me, Abelard. If you had only maintained your pledged faith to Vera Kelland years ago, none of these aberrations would have occurred."
"Aberrations?" Lindsay smiled icily.
"Decent of you to mop up after me, cousin, to tie up my loose ends. Small wonder, when you left so many pernicious ones."
Constantine sipped his water.
"Appeasement policy, for instance. Detente. It was typical of you to fast-talk a population into disaster and then sundog off when it came to the crunch."
Lindsay showed interest.
"Is that the new party line? To blame me for the investor piece? How flattering. But is it wise to bring up the past? Why remind them that you lost the Republic?"
Constantine's knuckles whitened on the goblet.
"I see that you're still an antiquarian. Odd that you should embrace Wellspring and his cadre of anarchists."
Lindsay nodded.
"I know that you'll attack Tarina Cluster if you have the chance. Your hypocrisy astounds me. You're no shaper. Not only are you unplanned, but your use of mech techniques is notorious. You're a living demonstration of the power of detente. You seize advantage wherever you find it, but deny it to anyone else."
Constantine smiled.
"I'm no shaper. I'm their guardian. It's been my fate, and I've accepted it. I've been alone all my life, except for you and Vera. We were fools then."
"I was the fool," Lindsay said.
"I killed Vera for nothing. You killed her to prove your own power." "The price was bitter, but the proof was worth it. I've made amends since then."
He drained his goblet and stretched out his arm.
Vera Kelland took the cup. Around her neck, she wore the gold filigree locket she had worn in the crash, the locket that was meant to guarantee his death.
Lindsay was dumbstruck. He had not seen the girl's face when her back was turned. She did not meet his eyes. Lindsay stared at her in icy fascination. The resemblance was strong, but not perfect. The girl turned and left. Lindsay forced the words.
"She's not a full clone."
"Of course not. Vera Kelland was unplanned."
"You used her genetics?"
"Do I hear envy, cousin? Are you claiming her cells loved you and not me?"
Constantine laughed. Lindsay tore his gaze from the woman. Her grace and beauty wounded him. He felt shell-shocked, panicky.
"What will happen to her when you die here?"
Constantine smiled quietly.
Why not mull that over while we fight?
I'll make you a pledge, Lindsay said. I swear that if I win, I'll spare your congenetics in the years to come.
My people are loyal to the Ring Council. Your Tsarina cluster rabble are their enemies. They're bound to come in conflict.
Surely that will be grim enough without our adding to it.
You're naive, Abelard. Tsarina cluster must fall.
Lindsay looked aside, studying Constantine's group. They don't look stupid, Philip. I wonder if they won't rejoice at your death. They might be swept away in the general celebration.
Idle speculation always bores me, Constantine said.
Lindsay glared. Then it's time we put the matter to the proof. Heavy curtains were spread over one of the huge alien tables, falling to the floor. Beneath the table's sheltering expanse, the blazing light was dimmer, and a pair of supportive waterbeds were brought in to combat investor gravity. The arena itself was tiny, a fist-sized dodecahedron, its triangular sides so glossily black that they shimmered with faint pastels. Wire trailed from metal-bound sockets in two opposing poles of the structure. The wires led to two goggle-equipped helmets with flexible neck extensions. The helmets had the blunt utilitarian look of mechanist manufacture. Constantine won the toss and took the right-hand helmet. He produced a flat, curved lozenge of beige plastic from his gold-threaded coat and hooked an elastic strap to its anchor loops.
A spatial analyzer, he explained. One of my routines. Permitted?
Yes. Lindsay pulled a flesh-colored strip of dotted adhesive discs from his breast pocket. PDKL-95, he said, in doses of 200 micrograms. Constantine stared.
Shatter? From the cataclysts?
No, Lindsay said. This was part of the stock of Michael Carnassus. Its original mechanist issue for the embassies. Interested?
No, Constantine said. He looked shaken. I protest. I came here to fight Abelard Lindsay, not a shattered personality.
That scarcely matters now, does it? This is to the death, Constantine. My humanity would only get in the way. Constantine shrugged.
Then I win no matter what.
Constantine attached the spatial analyzer, fitting its custom-made curves against the back of his skull. Its micro-prongs slid smoothly into the jacks connected to his right hemisphere. With its use, space would assume a fantastic solidity. Movement would show with superhuman clarity. Constantine lifted the helmet and caught a glimpse of his own sleeve. Lindsay saw him hesitate, studying the fabric's complex interwoven topology. He seemed fascinated. Then he shuddered briefly and slid his head within the helmet. Lindsay pressed the first dosage against his wrist and donned his headpiece. He felt the adhesive eye cusps grip his sockets, then a wash of numbness as local anesthetic took effect, and threads of stiffened biogel slid over the eyeballs to penetrate his optic nerves. He heard a faint, annihilating ringing as other threads wormed past his eardrums into predetermined chemotactic contact with his neurons. They both lay back on their waterbeds, waiting as the helmet's neck units soaked through pre-drilled micro-holes in the seventh cervical vertebra. The micro-threads grew their way harmlessly through the myelin casings of the spinal axons in a self-replicating gelatin web. Lindsay floated quietly. The PDKL was taking hold. As the spinal cutoff proceeded, he felt his body dissolving like wax, each sensory clump of muscle sending a final warm glow of sensation as the neck unit shut it off, a last twinge of humanity, too thin to be called pain. The shatter helped him forget. By rendering everything novel, it was intended to rob everything of novelty. While it broke up preconceptions, it heightened the powers of comprehension so drastically that entire intuitive philosophies boiled up from a single moment of insight. It was dark. His mouth tasted of cobwebs. He felt a brief wave of vertigo and terror before the shatter aborted it, leaving him suddenly stranded in an emotional no-man's land, where his fear transmuted itself bizarrely into a crushing sense of physical weight. He was crouching next to the base of a titanic wall. Before him, dim sheens of radiance gleamed from a colossal arch. Beside it, jutting balustrades of icy stone were shrouded in thin webs of sagging, dust-covered cable. He reached out to touch the wall and noted with dulled surprise that his arm had transmuted itself into a pallid claw. The arm was jointed in pale armor. It had two elbows. He began crawling up the wall. Gravity accompanied him. Looking out with new perspective, he saw that bridges had transformed themselves into curved columns. Loops of sagging cable were now vicious, stiffened arches. Everything was old. Something behind his eyes was opening. He could see time lying on the world like a sheen, a frozen blur of movement chopped out of context and painted onto the surface of the cold stone like alien shellac. Walls became floors, balustrades, cold barricades. He realized then that he had too many legs. There were legs where his ribs should have been, and the crawling feeling in his stomach was a literal crawling. The sensations from his guts were transmuted into the movement of his second pair of limbs. He struggled to look at himself. He could not curl forward, but his back arched with fantastic ease, and his lidless eyes gazed at armored plates thick with intersegmental fur. A pair of wrinkled organs protruded on stalks from his back. He brushed his muzzle against them, and suddenly, dizzyingly, he smelled yellow. He tried to scream then. He had nothing to scream with. He flopped back against the cold rock. Instinct seized him, and he scuttled headlong across acres of porous, gritty stone toward the safe darkness of a huge, jutting cornice and a rack-like checkerboard of rust-eaten bars. Proportion left him as he crouched there, wobbling in a hideous burst of intuition. And he realized that he was tiny, infinitesimal, that the titanic, mortared blocks that dwarfed him must themselves be small, so small that... He jabbed at the porous stone with a raking flex of his foreclaw. It was solid, solid with a weary durability that waited out uncaring eons, painted with the feeble dust of huge groaning machinery run past the point of uselessness into an utter exhaustion of grit. He could smell the age of it, even feel it as a kind of pressure, a kind of dread. It was massive, unyielding, and he thought suddenly of water. Water moving at high speed was as hard as steel. His mind rocketed off then, and he thought of the identity of speed and substance, the kinetic energy of atoms giving form to hard stone, stone which was empty space. It was all abstract structure, ageless form, level after level. Emptiness permeated by disturbances of emptiness, waves, quanta. He became aware of fine detail within the stone, the surface suddenly no more than frozen smoke, a hard fog petrified by captive eons. Below the surface, a finer level, detail on obsessive detail in an ever-recessive web. He was attacked. The enemy was on him. He felt a sudden ghastly rending as claws tore into him from above. The alien pain garbled in translation, cramming his brain with black nausea and dread. He flopped in death-stricken convulsions. His face slid apart in a nightmare extrusion of razored mandibles, and he caught a leg and sheared it off at the joint. He smelled hot hunger and pain, and the bright-hot radiance of his own juices bursting. And then the cold, the seeping, the bright spark fading to become one with the old stone, and the age and the dark. The exterior microphones of his helmet caught Constantine's voice, and it fed through his nerves.
Abelard?
Lindsay's throat was full of rust.
I hear you. You're alive?
The nerve block in his neck half dissolved, and he felt his own body as insubstantial as warm gas. He groped for the strip of dermadisc beside his head. The perforated plastic felt as thin as ribbon. He peeled off another disc with his fingers and pressed it raggedly against the base of his thumb.
We must try again. What did you see, Abelard? I must know.
Halls, walls, dark stones.
And gulfs?
black gulfs of nothing bigger than God.
I can't talk.
The other dose was hitting him. Language was collapsing, a tangle of irrelevant assumptions shattered by sudden doubt, wads of grammar mashed beneath the impact of the drug.
Again.
He was back. He could feel the enemy now, sense his presence as a weak, distant tingling. The light was clearer, gigantic, radiant washes seeping through masses of stone so rotten with age that they were thin as cloth. Fastidiously, he ran his foreclaws through the polyps around his mouth, cleansing them of damp grime. He felt a sense of hunger so overwhelming that the scales equalized, and he realized that the urge to live and kill was as huge as the vaults around him. He found the enemy crouched within a cul-de-sac between a harsh, decaying bridge and its supporting beams. He smelled the fear. The enemy's position was wrong. The enemy clung to the wall in a false perspective, perceiving the endless horizon as a shattering abyss. The gulf below was an eternal one, a chaos of walls, chambers, landings, self-replicating, built from nothing, a terrifying ramification of infinity. He attacked, biting deep into the back plates, the taste of hot ooze driving him into frenzy. The enemy slashed back, digging, pushing, pale claws scraping the rock. His jaws ripped free from the enemy's back. The enemy struggled to push him away, to shove him backward into the horizon. For a moment, he was gripped by the enemy's own perspective. He knew suddenly that if he fell, he would fall forever. Into the abyss, plunging into his own terror and defeat, endlessly, through the self-spinning labyrinth, mind frozen in boundless anguish. A maze of unending experience, unending fright, implacable walls, halls, steps, ramps, crypts, vaults, passages, always icy, always out of reach. He skidded back. The enemy was desperate, scrabbling convulsively, galvanized with pain. His own claws were slipping. The stone was rejecting him, becoming slicker. Suddenly, the breakthrough came, and he saw the world for what it was. His claws slid in, then, with phantom ease, stone slipping aside like smoke. Then he was anchored. The enemy pushed at him helplessly, uselessly. He tasted the sudden gush of despair as the enemy turned to flee. He ran him down at once, caught him, and rended him. A miasma of dust and terror burst from the enemy's flesh. He ripped him free from the wall, held him out in an orgasm of hatred and victory, and flung him into the gulf.